You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you, Scott. Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Exchange. Before this long weekend, I'm Kelly Evans, and here's what's ahead. Fizzling out, like Scott just mentioned, stocks are off their highs as investors fret that June's strong job gains won't last. Why? The stay-at-home trade is outperforming again today. Should you stick with these stocks or not? We'll dig into all of it and ask. Plus, bankruptcies could spark another financial crisis. That's the warning from a key Fed member today. We'll look at the risks and what, if anything, can be done to stave this off. And inside Moderna, the stock has tripled this year as they become a front runner in the race for a COVID vaccine. But are investors missing part of the story? We'll have that. But we begin with today's markets, and Dom Chu is here with those numbers.
Very much green to close out this holiday-shortened week. But like you said, we're off the best levels of the day because we are seeing some reports that certain key states and hotspots for the COVID pandemic might be seeing a rise in cases. So, yes, a good jobs number. But still, the Dow Industrial's up over 400 points at the highs of the day, up about 1%, 250 right now. The S&P 500 approaching 3150, up about 1% as well. And the NASDAQ gets a gold star because it hits another record intraday high today. It's been positive 13 of the last 15 sessions. One other trade that we've been watching, growth stocks versus value stocks. 2020 has been all about those growthy type names. Look at these two ETFs to track it. One does, IWF tracks growth. IWD, that ticker, tracks value. Look at the gap that's developing here, and it's just getting wider and wider. We'll see if that trade keeps on going. And by the way, this growth ETF is at a record high. And check out these stocks. They could be growth. They could be mega cap tech or consumer discretionary. They could be COVID-19 plays, or they could just be mega cap technology. All of these, Amazon, Microsoft, PayPal Holdings, they've all now hit record intraday highs in trading today. So they could be considered, Kelly, plays on COVID, but they've also been on shopping lists for years now. We'll see if that trade continues. Back over to you.
All right, Dom, thank you very much, sir. A record 4.8 million jobs were added in the U.S. in June as businesses reopened. The unemployment rate fell to 11.1%. But a big part of the job gains were in sectors like leisure and hospitality that may be at risk now from renewed closures. Here to dig through the report and offer some advice to investors, Charlie Babrinsky is head of the investment group at Ariel Investments, and Michelle Meyer is head of U.S. economics at Bank of America Global Research. Great to have you both here. Michelle, let me just start with you on the jobs report. Are you concerned that these gains are going to be unwound?
Well, you know, it's possible, of course, to the extent to which the virus continues to rise and the reopenings are reversed or economies are shut back down. But more than that, I think it's just going to be a likely slowing. And I think from here on, it's going to be a much bumpy path. So it's going to be kind of more fits and starts. So in a sense, the last 2 months, the 7.5 million jobs, the 34% recovery of the cumulative 22 million jobs that were lost. That was kind of the easy restoration of jobs. Here on, I think it does become more difficult, and I think it's going to vary depending on the industry you're in, and very importantly, depending on the region you're in, given what we're seeing now with the return of the virus.
Yeah. Also, let me welcome in Terry Spath to this conversation. She's Chief Investment Officer at Sierra Mutual Funds. Charlie, let me turn to you and your thoughts on kind of what's how the macro picture is evolving. I know when we last spoke, which was a little while ago, you were really optimistic on how quickly the economy was recovering. Is that optimism now tempered somewhat?
Unfortunately, the answer is yes. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. We were very bullish on the recovery. We thought we could see the data pretty clearly ahead of us. We thought things were going to peak in the middle of April and get better, frankly, relatively quickly. A lot of the work we did in talking to managers who'd laid people off was those people saying that they were putting people on unemployment so that they could get unemployment insurance, but that they planned to hire them back pretty quickly. And I will say that the recent case numbers have put a little bit of a dent in that. We did not see this happening. Obviously, the death numbers continue to trend down, but I'm here in Florida on vacation, and there's no doubt that the restaurants are less busy today than they were when I was here for Memorial Day. So this is a critical time. The market does not want to see a reversal in the direction of the news. The reason the market's up so much is because the news reversed and became positive. If it reverses and becomes negative, that is going to be ugly.
You know, Charlie, one of the themes that I hear a lot, especially from our friend John Spallanzani with Miller Funds, is that if you aren't sort of long or bullish on stocks in the longer run. You're basically short the U.S. government and its massive firepower and science. Every scientist, every, you know, biotech company who's working on a vaccine, you know, is he right? In the long run, even that concern that you're expressing, won't it be met with some sort of government response? And aren't we all expecting that at some point we're going to get some really good news on the vaccine front?
So yes on one, no on the other. So absolutely, if we get a vaccine, if science comes through here and cures this, then that's going to be very positive. But no, you don't have to make a bet on government. If massive government spending was the secret to economic benefit, Venezuela and Latin America would be ruling the world. Massive government spending is no guarantee of economic vibrancy. And so we've already had massive government spending. We've put a Band-Aid on a situation, a very important Band-Aid on the situation, but that absolutely, that firepower is not enough to save companies that have empty restaurants or oil companies where there's no demand for gas. The science, yes. The government, no.
Interesting, because that was part two, Terry, of what we were speaking with Larry Lindsey about yesterday. He had a 4,000 price target on the S&P in the longer run, more looking at the end of next year, saying he's just looking at the liquidity, the money supply, how much that's Fed's balance sheet has expanded and will continue to do so, and thinks that that translates into that kind of those kinds of gains for the stock market. I know you guys are in some different kinds of plays. What are those plays, and why do you think that's where investors should be right now?
Right. I mean, I 100% agree that all of that government spending has been a Band-Aid, and it's been a good Band-Aid, but risk still matters. We say it all the time. Risk still matters. Discipline still matters. In this market that we've seen such huge run-ups from the bottom, you know, we've probably seen the bottom because of all that government spending, because of what the Fed has done, but you absolutely have to pay attention to the downside and the drawdown that that you're putting yourself at risk on if you just buy like a zombie and just say, oh, I'm going to buy anything because there's some good headlines today. So we're looking at the trade-offs between upside and downside. And so, for example, we like emerging market debt over emerging market equity.
Yep.
Less risk, similar return.
Yep. No, I wish we could continue talking. We actually just got some breaking news on the coronavirus front. Let's get to that. And thank you all, Charlie Babrinskoy, Terry Spath, Michelle Meyer. Let's bring in Meg Terrell now, who does have more on this breaking news out of Moderna. Meg, what's going on?
Hi, Kelly. Well, I've been corresponding with Moderna's CEO, Stéphane Bancel. He tells me they are still on track to begin their COVID-19 phase three trial in July. Now, the Stat News story is reporting that there might have been some delay from a planned start on July 9th, but that it could still start this week due to a change in the trial protocols. And just what I'm getting here is that the trial will still start, the phase three trial, this month. You know, there are always small changes to the protocol, but all of the endpoints, all of the same size, the dose plan, all of that remains the same. So Moderna telling me they do plan to start this phase three trial this month, Kelly.
But Meg, so let's back up for a second. So Stat News reported that the trial start date was delayed. Is Moderna confirming that, but saying it will still happen in July?
They are not guiding by the day. I hadn't heard from the company that they plan to start on July 9th. My colleague at Stat News, Damian Garde, reported that the investigators of the trial, now that's the people at the clinical trial sites who run the trial, he's saying from his reporting they had said it planned to start that day, and now it might be delayed from that day. So we're talking potentially about the difference in a couple weeks here. Moderna is saying no change to their guidance that the trial will start this month.
Interesting. And we're going to actually talk a lot more about Moderna in just a couple of minutes with Greg Zuckerman from The Wall Street Journal. Meg, while we have you here, though, we do want to hit on the 4th of July weekend, some of the warnings that we're hearing from authorities about making sure that the spike in COVID cases doesn't accelerate. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so we're heading into the second holiday weekend of the summer, the first, of course, being Memorial Day weekend. And a lot of public health experts are saying we might have started to see cases rise as people saw that weekend as a chance to kind of go back to normal. We heard from CDC's Ann Schuchat on this earlier this week. Here's what she said.
There was a lot of wishful thinking around the country that, hey, summer, everything's going to be fine. We're over this. And we are not even beginning to be over this.
And so we are hearing from public health departments from around the country, all of them telling people socially distance, wear your masks, try to stay home if you can, stay within tight family groups. There are some states that are actually closing some beaches and parks in order to try to help people avoid being close together. California, Texas, Florida, Colorado, among the states that are urging people to be safe so that they don't crowd ERs this weekend, saying, quote, we really need to everyone to get through this weekend with all their fingers intact. Perhaps, Kelly, talking about some of the home fireworks shows that people might be putting on this weekend,
which we are also going to discuss in a minute. But Meg, last thing on this front before we let you go, the testing, you know, this has become an issue anecdotally as I've heard people who are trying to get their results around in my area. The delays are happening again. Is that related to the spike in cases? What's going on the testing front?
Yeah, so capacity has gone up a lot, but the demand has also gone up tremendously. And so we are starting to see more delays. And some of the biggest testing companies, Quest and LabCorp, warning about the turnaround times. And you're hearing about people having to wait a long time even to be able to find a place to get a test. So we are in a situation where as these surges happen, the testing is again becoming a problem.
Yeah, frustrating. All right, Meg, thank you very much for all of that. Meg Terrell with all the news on the COVID front. Coming up, bankruptcies could lead to a financial crisis. That's what Fed President James Bullard is warning. How concerned should investors be and what areas of the economy are most at risk? Plus, one China expert says the passing of the new Chinese security law in Hong Kong is a wake-up call to the U.S. and could be the end of the city. He'll join us. Take a look at today's biggest S&P 500 winners, Mosaic, Hanesbrands, Lincoln National, and Apache. We're back in two here on The Exchange.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
Welcome back. St. Louis Fed President James Bullard warning today that the spike in coronavirus cases could lead to more Chapter 11 filings, telling the Financial Times that, quote, without more granular risk management on the part of health policy, we could get a wave of substantial bankruptcies and that could feed into a financial crisis. So what could a wave look like in which industries are most vulnerable? Joining me now is Steve Odlin, president and CEO of the Conference Board and a CNBC contributor. It's great to have you back. And it's interesting that both you and the Fed president are together focused on this issue. What are you guys seeing out there that has you so on edge?
Well, you know, if you look at the early part of this recovery, Kelly, it looks a little bit like a V moving from April to May, but inevitably that's going to flatten. So take retail sales, for example, in May. It popped off the bottom at up 18% from the prior month. Everybody's declaring victory, but remember, that's still down 6% versus a year ago. And those sales are artificially buoyed. You just have to look at what's going on underneath those numbers. 106 million debt payments were missed in May. There's a 130% increase in loan delinquency rate. 2.4 million properties are past due. Government transfers to households in that month was running at a $3 trillion rate. And 62% of people receiving unemployment are getting money higher than they would working. So, and then look at the income tax delay. So people who owe income taxes now have that incremental money. So if you look at personal income without the government transfers, it's down 30%. So you can see how this is going to flatten and it affect businesses. So the bankruptcy rate through May is running at 256,000 bankruptcies. Now, there's a lot of small businesses and companies in that, but the major bankruptcy rates are running double a year ago. And with all of this coming through and with layoffs coming behind it as government assistance wears off, we're really worried about an increase in those bankruptcies.
Yeah, an interesting side note on the debt payments missed. A lot of those were actually student loan payments, which is a separate issue, I think, points to another problem that is just going to continue to hang over not only the economy, but also these individuals who are trying to figure out which payments to make and not make. So let's talk about some of the bankruptcy candidates that you're most focused on. That most obvious, bricks and mortar retail, but there's others in here as well. Hotels, restaurants also make sense. Everything travel, but also you're saying auto dealers, smaller home builders, commercial real estate. Talk through some of those and why you see risks there.
Yeah, I think that the bricks and mortar, you know, retail and restaurants are pretty obvious, and all the travel stuff is pretty obvious. But, you know, when you start seeing the ripple effect through, you know, these sales and what's going to happen, you know, these smaller auto dealers just are not going to survive. They can't. The big chains obviously can't. Home building is down. You know, the you've got some purchasing going on, you know, most notably in the suburban areas. But that's going to slow down. And then you've got, theaters. I think that anything where you have out-of-home gatherings like entertainment and theaters and shopping centers, I think people are going to have a behavioral change, even if the government doesn't step in. And I do think the government's going to step in and slow it down again. So all of that then has a ripple effect. These commercial real estate owners and, you know, ultimately REITs and so forth are seeing non-payments. And that's going to be a big problem. And it's going to ripple through the financial sector. And we're not looking at this as a financial crisis. But what happens when you have to mark to market finally on all of these loans and the assets behind it if there's no income flow, you know, from the ripple effect? So you have to look at the steps in the chess game. And it, you know, it's worrisome, Kelly.
So I'm also curious what you think could forestall us from going down this path, especially some of the comments Bullard was making. Mergers, for example. I mean, what kind of intra-industry moves could we see that could maybe help some of the weaker players find a different option than closing their doors?
Well, and, you know, this is what economists look at, because they say, well, look, the weakness was there in a lot of these players pre-COVID. And, you know, a dynamic economy wants to see the weak players taken out so that capital is released and you invest in the more productive elements of the economy. So over the long run, you look at this and you go, well, this is really, you know, a good thing to happen. But if you're sitting there as one of these job holders or, you know, one of these debt holders, that's not a good thing. And so I think what we have to do is we have to I think this is why, the Fed is stepping up and saying, you know, we're going to use our balance sheet and every tool that we've thought of and some more that we haven't thought of. I think we also need, more help on the retraining and the unemployment side, not to make it more, more productive to stay home, but to make sure that we, you know, keep the jobs in the system as we go. So I think, you know, more of the SBA loans and so forth to keep these companies going through what will be a prolonged shutdown, Kelly.
And we didn't talk energy, but the oil and gas rig count this week, record low for the ninth week. There's another area to be on alert about. Steve, thank you, sir, and appreciate the thoughts, some of the creative solutions here as well.
Great to see you.
Steve Eidland with the Conference Board. Coming up, McDonald's is pausing reopenings as cases surge in many cities. Are more restaurant closings coming? And which stocks are most at risk from that, we'll ask. Plus, in just the last hour, the Senate joining the House and passing a bill targeting banks over China's Hong Kong security law. Is it just the start of U.S. action? What does it all mean for investors? We'll have that. Remember, you can always watch or listen to us live on the go on the CNBC app. The Exchange is back in a couple. Welcome back to The Exchange. Let's check on the markets right now, where we are well off the session highs, but still up pretty nicely this afternoon. The Dow up 224 points. We're up better than 400 after that jobs report for June initially hit the tape. It was much better than expected, but the optimism has moderated as we've moved throughout the session. Just under a 0.9% gain for the Dow. Similar amount for the S&P. It's up 29 to 31.45. The NASDAQ Composite is the outperformer today. That's definitely a theme, up better than 1% to back above 10,270. Let's check on the sectors. Energy is actually the outperformer today, up 1.5%, even though we just got that rig count news, record low, ninth straight week. Pretty much everybody else is up fractionally. Real estate, though, that is the only sector in the red right now, and it is coming off a pretty strong run of late. Here are some of the individual movers this hour. Tesla, once again, up with a big beat on second quarter deliveries with more than 90,000. That's more than the 72,000 that was expected. The stock is up 7.5% today. It's over $1,200 a share. It's up 25% just this week. Meantime, China-based electric vehicle maker NIO also higher today. It also had record deliveries in June and in the second quarter, though nowhere near Tesla's numbers. The company exceeded guidance with more than 3,700 deliveries in June, more than 10,000 for its second quarter. NIO shares are up 17% to $9.25 today. And DocuSign getting a price target hike from $170 to $210 at RBC, the bank expecting them to take a disproportionate share of the workflow digitization market. DocuSign, recent IPO, up 9%. Over to Sue Herrera now for our CNBC News update. Sue?
Thanks so much, Kelly. And here is what's happening at this hour, everyone. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden criticizing President Trump's record on jobs, despite better-than-expected data out this morning.
We're still in a deep, deep job hole. because Donald Trump has so badly bungled the response to the coronavirus and now has basically given up on responding at all. You know, a million more Americans would, millions of them would still have their job if Donald Trump had done his job.
Kansas Governor Laura Kelly issuing an executive order requiring face coverings in public and in workplaces. Kansas is among the state reporting more new cases as the daily total tops 50,000 nationwide. And nine more NBA players have tested positive for the coronavirus, and the league plans to resume its season on July 30th. A still developing story. You are up to date. That's the news update this hour. Kelly, I'll send it back to you.
All right, Sue, thank you very much. Now, the Senate just joined the House in passing a bill to sanction Chinese banks after China began enforcing a new national security law in Hong Kong. The bill now goes to President Trump for his signature. The new law is a massive and fundamental change that gives China a strong hand in policing dissent in Hong Kong. Could it be the death of the city as we know it and cause a new rift in U.S.-China relations? Joining me now is Michael Schuman, a contributor to The Atlantic and author of the new book, Superpower Interrupted: The Chinese History of the World. It's great to have you here, Michael. And I mean, what do investors need to know about this situation?
What investors need to know is that, you know, the Hong Kong that we've known, the Hong Kong that's been a major financial center in the world, is kind of eroding before our eyes. I mean, what makes Hong Kong Hong Kong? What's made this place work? It's because it has had rule of law, it's had independent judiciary, it's had free flow of information. This is stuff you can't get on the mainland. Remember, you know, 15 years ago, there were experts predicting that Shanghai was going to take Hong Kong's place as China's international financial center. It never happened. It never happened because Hong Kong had stuff that China doesn't have. And this law starts to take that away. And it's going to be, it's businesses are operating here are really going to have to think hard going forward about what it means for them. And can they, do they want to operate in this environment going forward?
Yeah, and you know, the interesting thing sometimes, I get a couple different responses when this issue comes up with different people. Some say Hong Kong will be fine, you know, this is all a lot of hoopla, and, you know, give it, you know, a few years and nothing's really going to change that much. That's one thing I hear. Another thing is sort of, all right, so we'll go to Singapore. I mean, no one's that concerned about Hong Kong itself, or they think that, you know, it's going to weather this and all, you know, the path that it's taking is being exaggerated.
Look, I mean, there's not going to be a stampede for the airport tomorrow with people, you know, packing up their desks and, you know, making a run for it. But, you know, think about what this law means going forward. It means bringing in the kind of arbitrary rule that you have on the mainland. And I think the biggest risk to business here is really the loss of talent. What are Hong Kong people going to do who have grown up in an environment where they've had certain civil liberties? They could educate their children well. Are they really going to want to stay here? I mean, the UK and other countries are talking about opening their door to more people from Hong Kong to emigrate. I think that's going to happen. And what that means is that all that talent that companies count on, foreign companies and local companies count on, to run these businesses here so successfully, you know, may not be there in 5 years or 10 years.
Yeah, it is really, really sad. And I'm curious. So, again, for those who say, all right, well, you know, tough for Hong Kong. But again, why do I need to care? Why should I get involved in China's, you know, domestic politics? I mean, China plays this issue out very effectively on the national stage, even in regards to that whole NBA issue last year. They say, this is our business. You don't like it tough. It's not your problem.
Well, I mean, what I hope is, yeah, I mean, you can easily say, why do we care about a city of 7 million people halfway around the world? But, you know, I'm hoping that this is kind of a wake-up call to people around the world, especially in the Western democracies, that, you know, if you're divided, if you're not focused on these bigger issues on a global basis, that every time you step back, every time the U.S. steps back, Europe steps back, the Chinese are going to try to fill that space, and they don't share our values. So I'm hoping that Hong Kong may be a turning point where you know, the West, that's been very, very divided amongst itself, really hasn't gotten together in the way that it needs to stand up to China on these issues. It's going to see what's going on in Hong Kong and say, you know, we have to be ready for the next battle. Maybe we lost this battle, but we have to be ready for the next battle. And there will be other battles.
Yeah.
Because the Chinese state is going to want to continue to expand its influence in this way.
Tell me about Taiwan, where the U.S. has a guaranteed defense treaty, right? I mean, you look at the response by most of the American public to what's going on, and you wonder if we would have the stomach to step up in some kind of confrontation with China as it relates to Taiwan?
Well, you know, I think what Hong Kong tells us is that from Beijing's perspective, they've calculated that the U.S. and its allies don't have the stomach for these fights. Maybe Taiwan will be different. Obviously, there's a very different relationship, as you mentioned, between Taiwan and Washington than there is with Hong Kong. But what Hong Kong tells us is that, you know, Beijing thinks that it can break its international agreements. It can do basically what it wants, and that ultimately the West is going to make a lot of noise and put on a few sanctions, but ultimately not really do anything else and still continue to do business and invest in China. Mm-hmm. But there will be other red lines. Taiwan may be the next red line. And this is the decision Washington is going to have to make. Are we ready for these battles with China? I hope Washington is ready for these battles because they will come.
One final question. What happens after the fall? I mean, do you get the sense that China has a preferred candidate one way or the other, or that the U.S. policy towards China will change significantly one candidate to the other?
I mean, it's very hard to know what the leadership of China is actually thinking. I'm sure they're watching it very, very closely. On the one hand, obviously, they've had a rough go with Donald Trump over the last 3 years with the trade war and sanctions and other things. At the same time, you know, Trump provides them with some nice opportunities. He doesn't really pay a whole lot of attention to what's going on in Asia. He's not personally interested in some of these human rights and geostrategic issues. So to a certain extent, he's ceding space to China to fill in. And China actually obviously finds that very, very, very positive for its interests long term. In that way, a Democratic presidency where you have, you know, Joe Biden is talking about working much more closely with allies in a coalition against China. That actually sounds much scarier to China. If you really had the world's democracies gang up on China and try to isolate China and try to force them to change some of these practices, that actually may be a little bit scarier than what Donald Trump has been doing.
Interesting. Michael, it's been great to have you. Thanks for all your thoughts.
Thank you.
Michael Schuman is author of Superpower Interrupted, The Chinese History of the World. Going to take a quick break. Coming up, Moderna shares are tumbling on reports that one of its key trials is being delayed as it relates to a COVID vaccine. The company denies it, but it may have all of Wall Street wondering if there are deep-rooted issues at this biotech firm. We'll explore that with the shares down 6% next. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Exchange. Shares of Moderna have nearly tripled this year as the biotech firm has become one of the front runners in developing a new coronavirus vaccine. Despite not having a single medicine currently on the market, a new story in the Wall Street Journal looks at the man at the helm of the company and what they describe as Moderna's culture of relentlessness. For more, I'm joined by one of the reporters behind the story. Greg Zuckerman is senior writer at the Wall Street Journal. Greg, welcome. It's good to see you.
Great to see you, and thank you for forcing me to shave this morning. So that's great.
Hey, you don't have to shave. We'll take the bearded look if that's what you want.
Next time.
So let me start with the culture of relentlessness that might, to investors, sound like a great thing. Hey, that's exactly what we want. We want the Jeff Bezos, you know, the Amazon approach. Why is it a double-edged sword in Moderna's case?
Yeah, and you can make that argument. A lot of people make the comparison to kind of Steve Jobs and those kinds of entrepreneurs and executives. There's a line you don't want to cross, right? So you want morale to be strong and you want people working hard for a common cause. And they have a very unique culture where Stefan and others work very hard. It's a relentless environment. It's a difficult environment, long hours. He pushes them. He calls them out. If he thinks they're a little slow, he tells them as such. And like you said, that can create real progress and even breakthroughs. And if they are the ones, it's not clear, they're one of the front runners here. If they're the ones who bring us all a vaccine, then we'll be thankful for that unique, difficult culture.
Right. And you're referring to the CEO, Stefan Bancel. But some of the other red flags for investors have been the fact that this company has 20 plus experimental drugs and vaccines, but none that have been close to being commercially available to patients. The issue with the stock at all-time highs when they did a stock sale earlier this year, the fact that insiders, including the CEO, have been sellers of the stock. I mean, these are traditional red flags. What does the company say when you ask them?
Well, as you said, it's a sort of a battleground kind of stock, all kinds of passions. Just, you know, after we wrote the story, you should see the emails I've received. You have people that are very supportive and encouraged about their progress, and other people that think they're a sell right here and they're overstating things. The company addresses all the points and they say that the stock sales were pretty much all pre-planned, so you don't want to read too much into them. And they kind of say, hey, yes, we haven't produced anything yet, but we've made advances. And the skeptics will say that's not enough. And over 20 drugs, as you said, and they still haven't produced one yet. So it'll be fascinating to see if they're the ones, and they are one of the front runners.
Yeah, and you even also have a little bit in here about the history of some of their fundraising going back a few years when they were kind of looking across for investors. You had some who are biotech-focused investors who said they didn't feel the company published as much about their results and they were less transparent about their progress on various drugs than some rivals. What would the company's response to that be? Have they changed or improved on that front?
They've pushed back on that point. They say they were pretty transparent. They say there was just so much we could do. This was preclinical data. There was just so much we could share. It is interesting that he's a great salesman, and I don't mean that in any kind of critical way. I'm talking about the CEO, Stefan, and there are all kinds of interesting joint ventures they've done over the years with Merck and other kind of companies that encourage the bulls, but you don't have so many of the biotech specialists who've been on board for a long time, the hedge funds and mutual fund type people. You have some, but a lot of them have been skeptical and frankly have been selling over the past year, and they've been wrong, at least according to the stock price. So it's a fascinating situation where some of these super smart outsider type investors have been backers, and some of the skeptics have been biotech type focused investors, so specialists.
Do those specialists, Greg, that you speak to think Moderna can get it done, can actually develop and come to market as quickly as they've promised, which is potentially, you know, as soon as we're back to school in the fall with a coronavirus vaccine?
So no one really thinks by the fall, maybe for emergency purposes, which would be great. But we have to be realistic about how long these things take. They're doing now a phase three trial with 30,000 patients, subjects. So I don't think anybody really thinks that they can do anything in near term. But again, in the fall, you might get emergency use of this vaccine potentially. And you could argue that that would be enough to kind of reassure us in a lot of ways, take care potentially or address somewhat any potential second wave. So there are a lot of people, even in industry, even competitors, who think their strategy is a really interesting one. It's mRNA. It's a different type, messenger RNA, which is hasn't been proved yet. And if they can prove it, it'll open up a whole world to new potential drugs. But you got to still be kind of skeptical or at least raise some questions.
Final question, Greg. What did you make of the news? Just this afternoon, it's been playing out for the past 45 minutes or so. Stat News said that their trial was not going to start on what Stat News said was their plan for July 9th. The company telling our Meg Terrell they are still planning to begin this trial by the end of the month.
Yeah, well, the company is optimistic by nature. That's often how you get things done in the world. So they think they won't set them back too much. And, you know, protocols often change when it comes to these kinds of trials. You don't want to get thrown by the fact that it's moving a week or a few days or even a few weeks off. But they could lose their front runner status. There are kinds of all kinds of companies that are just behind them going to do their own trials with the government in August and September. So it is a new challenge. I wouldn't get too worked up about it, but you got to keep an eye on it.
Yeah. Greg, it's a great piece, and thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Great to see you again.
Greg Zuckerman from The Wall Street Journal. Coming up, if you've been waking up in the middle of the night to the sound of lots of fireworks, you are not alone. It's happening all across the country. More people using the product sounds great for the industry, right? Not necessarily. They are actually facing big problems. Jane Wells is here with a closer look at the new normal for them. Jane?
Yeah, Kelly, they're running out of inventory here. Better get your Piccolo Pete's while you can. Banner year for fireworks. And lest you put on displays, up next we go inside the military bunker of one of the biggest display companies in America. No smoking there or here when we come back.
Welcome back to The Exchange. The 4th of July may have fewer fireworks this year, but people have been setting them off illegally in neighborhoods across the country for weeks now. Jane Wells joins us with a closer look at how things are different and not necessarily strong on the fireworks front this year. Jane?
Hi, Kelly. Yeah, I'm in front of a Safe and Sane shop owned by TNT. These are legal fireworks here in Alhambra, but stop me if you've heard this one. Well, Americans are beginning an early jump on the 4th of July, and calls to police are way up. Now, some of these fireworks are not legal. In fact, some are homemade, but some are legal, and that's why business is booming and supplies are running out. But Well, business is good if you sell to consumers. It's terrible if you put on those big displays like the company behind the big Macy's show in New York. We met its president in a military-style bunker where they keep the goods.
2020 was shaping up to be the biggest year we ever had.
Now, Jim Souza, no relation to John Philip, his company has the Macy's show and Mount Rushmore, but COVID has forced the cancellation. Listen to this. 90% of business this week is gone. That's millions of dollars lost with a bang.
Normally, I'd be sitting here this time of year and saying we're getting ready to stage 400 shows, 400 trucks and permits, and hundreds of pyrotechnicians getting ready to celebrate the 4th of July. But this year, we're lucky if we're going to do 10% or 40%.
Now, his is a fifth-generation business, and Kelly, he applied for an SBA loan thinking he could qualify for the max of $2 million. He got $150,000, which he says will get him through August. Back to you.
Anything else people can do in terms of relief? I mean, the government or otherwise? It's interesting, Jane, because anecdotally, everyone around here seems to be talking about maybe trying some fireworks themselves. I mean, it's going to be a scary weekend.
It is. It's two different businesses, really. Someone like Jim Souza's company does not sell direct to consumers. He can't really pivot and do that revenue stream. What he's doing, like everybody else, he's trying to, you know, petition Congress for aid for what he calls an entertainment industry. His fear is that all the cities and sporting events that canceled fireworks shows this year, when next year come around, may think, you know, maybe we don't need to do that anymore. And that will be devastating, assuming he can even survive till next July.
And you don't think that demand from, you know, people in their neighborhoods, which, again, a lot of this might be a really bad idea in the first place, but at least it's demand, but it's just not
different.
Big enough. Yeah.
Look, TNT's doing great. They're doing great. But Pyro Spectaculars by Jim Souza, where they do 400 shows, terrible year.
No, like you said, down 90%. Well, maybe people listening will decide to bring back those fireworks shows and then some when they do finally come back. Jane, thank you so much. It's great to see you. Jane Wells for us. We appreciate it. Coming up, McDonald's pausing its plans for reopening as COVID cases rise. Will others follow suit? And what names are best positioned to weather this storm? A restaurant reality check is next. Take a look at shares of Lemonade as we go. The mobile-based insurance company going public today, priced above the range of 29. It opened above 50. It's over $60 right now. Here's the CEO on Squawk Alley earlier talking about their plans.
A lot of headroom ahead of us. We've been starting off with renters and homeowners and condo insurance. We've made it public that we're going to launch pet insurance pretty soon. But our ambitions are expansive and our customers have expectations. So we'll endeavor to fulfill them as quickly as we possibly can.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Airline stocks are moving slightly higher today after five of them reached an agreement with the Treasury for portions of the $25 billion in federal loans they need to weather the crisis. Part of those terms include no layoffs through September 30th, but what's to come after that is unknown. In fact, American Airlines telling its staff today it has more than 20,000 employees it doesn't need for its fall schedule. American shares are the only ones not in the green right now. And from the skies to the fries, McDonald's is halting its U.S. reopening plans as coronavirus cases spike across the country. The fast food giant says it'll wait 3 weeks before any new U.S. restaurants can add dine-in to their drive-through and takeout services. Franchisees who have already opened their dining rooms and aren't facing any local rollbacks can decide whether or not to keep them open. Currently, only 15% of McDonald's dining rooms are open in the U.S. For more on what this means for the company and the whole industry, I'm joined by R.J. Hadavi, sector strategist at Morningstar, and our very own Kate Rogers. Good to have you both. RJ, I'll just start with you. Can McDonald's weather this?
Yeah, I think they can. I mean, this is companies in one of the strongest positions in the restaurant industry. They've got a great value proposition. More than 70% of their transactions happen at the drive-through. And overall, corporate and franchisee financial health is very strong. And they won't be the only one to consider pausing the reopening plans. To be honest, the recovery in the restaurant industry wasn't going to be a straight line. It was going to have lots of ups and downs. And I think McDonald's is just the first to make this announcement.
Right. That's true. I mean, by making it first, they could lose some market share. But as you say, they could also be kind of giving everybody cover for making the same decision. Kate, I'm curious about the shift overall that we might be seeing here. The fast food players have been the strongest throughout coronavirus because they could keep those drive-thrus open. That was starting to shift. I mean, we had some nice rebounds off the lows for the restaurant, sort of the table stocks, as we'd call them. I wonder if we're going to see a little bit of a reversal of that now.
I think, Kelly, the players that have been the strongest throughout the pandemic, we name them all the time, Wingstop, Best Performer, Chipotle, Papa John's, and Domino's. And that's because they have these really robust carryout and delivery systems that are already in place. As RJ mentioned, obviously McDonald's does a lot of business through the drive-thru, but it's the first major chain we're seeing say, hey, we're going to stop, we're going to pause and assess what this means. Back in March, we saw Starbucks do that, if you remember. They decided to close down, you know, their in-store seating and dining. And then the rest of the industry kind of followed suit. I have a feeling we're going to see more of that and more bigger companies potentially putting things on hold as these case numbers continue to climb around the country.
Yep. And RJ, imagine we're still going to see a big macro effect from that, even though it's happening kind of company first instead of by the authorities. But I want to ask you about something that was big news yesterday and surprising to me. Pizza Hut's largest U.S. franchisee filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Now, they're also a big Wendy's franchisee, but RJ, I thought that pizza delivery, granted Pizza Hut is dining rooms, I get it, you know, but why Chapter 11? I mean, how did it get so bad for them?
Yeah, NPC International was in a challenging position even before any coronavirus regulations went into place. That was already a situation that the company was overlevered. To your point, had a lot more sit-down locations than the you know, delivery carryout model that we've seen from Domino's and Papa John's. So it was in a weak position financially. It was a weak position competitively. So no terrible surprise that NPC filed for bankruptcy. You're right. The QSR pizza category is on fire right now.
Yeah.
Most of the companies going up north of 20% comparable share sale. But this was the underperformer. And to be honest, was dragging down results across the board for Yum! Brands. This has got to be a positive. This is something where I think the company can shift some of the or close some of the weaker performing NPC locations, shift some of them to better performing locations, and really rethink about what consumers are looking for in the pizza category. Again, that delivery carryout model that Kate referenced, that's what works right now. Pizza doesn't need that. So I think this is a positive move, even if it takes some time to get them in the hands of the right operators.
Oh, that's super interesting. And that we're showing shares of Yum! Brands, Wendy's as well, the way they might be able to work this to their benefit in the long run. Kate, especially since you're here, I want to ask about the employment effect of all of this. You know, you have these companies starting to add workers back, getting ready to open those dining rooms, now putting that on pause. Like, it's the yo-yo that Tillman Fertitta was talking about yesterday, just this back and forth. What happens to those workers now?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kelly. So we're still millions below pre-pandemic levels when it comes to actual restaurant employment. And the National Restaurant Association said from March through May, 8 million jobs were either lost or workers were put on furlough. So it's going to have a huge effect. But remember, we've seen a lot of big hiring announcements from McDonald's, from Taco Bell, from Papa John's and Domino's throughout the pandemic and moving into the summer, because some of these players that had the delivery, drive-through, carryout options were doing better than most. McDonald's had the biggest hiring announcement, though, of 250,000 workers as it begins to reopen dining rooms. A lot of the franchisees will do that hiring, but whether or not this puts their plans on hold obviously remains to be seen.
Yeah, absolutely. RJ, run us through, if you can, the space and how, you know, where you think investors should put their money. Starbucks is your top pick. Who else do you like? Who should people stay away from?
Yeah, I like Starbucks just because, and the way to think about this category right now from an investment standpoint are not only the winners, but you know how the winners are going to take shape and which categories are going to be the most distressed coming out of this environment. Obviously, it's no surprise that sit-down restaurants, casual dining, fine dining are going to be disrupted. So in a space like that, I'd look at a player like Darden, which has the financial assets, has a wide portfolio of names. Starbucks is an interesting name just because, as Kate referenced, they've had to reclose. They've also seen some weaknesses from the morning day part, less morning commuters, less people coming to Starbucks. But if you look, too, especially coffee category is one of the most fragmented. Our estimates show that between 50 and 55% of the locations that are out there are owned by operators with three or less locations. That's going to be a group that's going to, we're going to see a lot of shakeout among that industry.
Yeah.
And even though it's going to take time for morning commuters to come back in, who's going to be waiting on the back end of that to pick up a lot of that market share? It's going to be Starbucks. And on top of that, they've got a great digital platform, you know, mobile order and pay system. You know, I think that all sets up well for this company. And on top of that, too, they've got a great at-home platform. So at least they can build the brand while people are
sure.
stuck in their houses. A name like, you know, Yum! Brands and QSR, Restaurant Brands International, too, we think are undervalued. But there is going to be a lot of ups and downs. And I think this is where you have to look longer term and be able to withstand some volatility. Because I think some of the, you know, demand that we saw pick up in June, May and June, I think it's going to subside a bit in July and August for either reclosing, macro reasons, or just even operational issues. It's going to be not easy to reopen. And there's going to be
yeah.
inevitably some situations where you see some additional viruses reporting at restaurant levels.
Yeah, absolutely. Kate, just real quickly before we go, when you last checked in with people survey-wise, I mean, what is the what is going on in terms of consumer interest in going to these restaurants.
Two interesting trends. Our own CNBC and Change Research survey basically went down in terms of the number of people who felt comfortable dining out. It went from 40% the last time we asked to 38% in the most recent poll. And then NPD Group's restaurant transaction data actually reversed. It was down by 12%, still negative. The last survey that they put out then this week said it was down by 13%. They had seen about 10 weeks of positive improvement. And as these cases begin to climb and continue to climb around the country, people are feeling less and less comfortable, and it's impacting the data for sure.
All right. Well, there we have it. A pretty full picture of what this industry is facing. Kate Rogers and RJ Hottovy, thank you both. Greatly appreciate it today. Want to get a quick news alert here on Boeing. Phil LeBeau with the details. Phil?
And Kelly, there's a report out of Bloomberg that Boeing has decided to pull the plug on its 747 program. We have reached out to Boeing. It says that it is still continuing to meet its commitments on the program, and it's got about 2 years worth of orders. If, in fact, the 747 is ultimately scrapped, it won't be a surprise, guys, because what you're looking at, Kelly, is a plane that has had fewer and fewer orders over time. Really, the days of the jumbo jet, they're past. So while this report is not going to move the needle for Boeing, it will make those who love the aviation industry a little sad when the day ultimately does come that Boeing will pull the plug on the 747. And again, no confirmation from Boeing at this point, but it won't be a surprise if, in fact, this is the case relatively soon, given the fact that they have very few orders left for this plane.
Yeah, stock coming off a stronger run recently, too, up about 20% in the past month. Phil, thank you, sir. We appreciate it. Phil LeBeau with that news. And that does it for The Exchange today.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.